All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Big day today. Big fan of the guy who's on today. Tracy Letts is here. He's a playwright and actor. You might know him from the most recent film, Lady Bird. He plays Molly Shannon's husband on that show, Divorce. He was in The Post. Letts is here. He wrote Bug. He wrote Killer Joe. He wrote August, Osage County. I love the way he acts. I feel like I know the guy, and it was great to have him in here to talk to him. It was nice. It was fun. It was familiar. It's weird when I get it in my mind that I know somebody. I act like I know him, and then either it takes or it doesn't. That's my style. If I think I know you, I'll try to impose that on you. And I did that. I did that with Letts to some success, I must say. I feel like we're close. I feel like we're friends. I feel like we could hang out. I feel like we could talk more. I also feel like I'll never see him again. Maybe I'll see him at an award show, which I did see him at an award show. I saw him at the Critics Award show. And then I talk about my problem with approaching people at award shows, and it yields something at the end. So there's a tease for you. Something went down. You know what I'm saying? Do you? How about an email? I got stories. I got things. I got comedy to do in a few hours. New York moment subject line. Hi, Mark. Just wanted to let you know I love the show. Like a lot of people our age, I'm 53. I've dealt with a lot of demons, ups and downs in my life, drinking too much and gambling on sport and in the biggest casino, the stock market. On an upward arc now. Saved marriage, curbed the boozing, stopped the gambling and working out on a regular basis. This leads me to my WTF moment. I'm working out, getting my sweat on at the local Equinox when this big dude asks to work in with me on a machine. I'm about 40 minutes into the workout and your interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, which I'm really enjoying. I look up and there he is standing in front of me working his set of reps. I blurted out, "You're Ta-Nehisi and you are talking to Mark Maron right now on my phone in the garage in L.A. Suffice it to say, I calmed down, had a chuckle and a nice chat with the guys we worked out. Classic WTF New York moment. Keep up the good work. Love the show." Well, that's fun, man. Good for you, Matt. I'm glad you got to meet that guy. He's a good guy. Oh, there was another email here that I thought was pretty funny. It was actually really ridiculous and funny. Where would that be? Where would that email be? Oh, here it is. Mr. Groover is the subject line. I woke up early this morning and decided to finish listening to your interview of Lori Kilmartin. At some point, you all began talking about Tim Robbins, and several times you both mentioned his role in Mr. Groover, which was directed by Clint Eastwood. I'd never heard of this role or this movie, so I did what I often do while listening to your podcast. I began to Google it. I finally gave up when I couldn't find any movie with Tim Robbins or Clint Eastwood with the name or character Mr. Groover. My husband and I have often discussed how when we listen to your podcast, we find ourselves going down rabbit holes looking up stuff on the internet. So when he woke up, I told him about my frustration in searching for Mr. Groover and coming up with nothing. I finally said the only movie I could find with Tim Robbins and Clint Eastwood was Mystic River. He looked at me like I was crazy and said, "Don't you think that's what they were saying?" It took me a minute, but it ends up that Mystic River sounds a lot like Mr. Groover when you say them out loud. I felt pretty stupid, but was glad to have the mystery solved, and we had a good little chuckle over it. I thought you would, too. We both love your podcast. Thanks for providing us hours of meaningful entertainment and for sending us down many rabbit holes. Peace, Lisa. Mr. Groover. Okay. I've been trying to get exercise. I'm trying to work off the craft services that I indulged on in the last couple of weeks of Glow, where I didn't give a fuck anymore. So I've been wanting to exercise. I've been wanting to run. My chest has been a little tight. The air has been a little shitty. But there are some hikes nearby to where I live now. And I didn't really know the hikes, but I went up to the place where they are. I went up to the park, and I lit out on one of these hikes, and I thought I was going in the right area. This happened fucking twice, two different areas. Like, I went up one hill, and then I'm like, I remember this being the hike, and I just hit this sort of strange dead end. And then I went up another area, And I went up there, and then I found myself in a wooded zone going up a steeper than seemed right incline with not any new footprints around. And as I went up, I smelled the stench of rotting flesh. I swear to God, I smelled death up there. I didn't know what it was. It smelled like a decomposing animal of some kind up on this in this slight clearing, but densely kind of weeded area up this incline. And once that smell hit me and I saw there was a drop off on the right side where something could have fell down there, but I didn't see anything. But it was that moment where the panic overtook me. You can't even walk outside now. You can't not, I guess you can, but I was by myself. I was in a new place, a new park. There was no one else on the trail, and I smelled rotting flesh. And it could have been a person, but did my curiosity take me up there? Did I say, you know, if that's a dead person up there that could be missing for a while, maybe I should go up there, check it out, and report it if that's the case? Did I do that? No, I did not. I made the assumption it was probably an animal. If it was a dead body, I couldn't help that dead body. And if it was an animal, I didn't want to be next, but to be taken down by whatever killed that one. So without even doing any exploration, I ran down the hill in a panic, and then that panic spread, and I didn't know if I was going to get just jumped by a mountain lion or just the guy with the knife in the bushes. There was the sort of broad mountain lion guy in the bushes with a knife panic that one gets on a hike. I turned my music off, and I'm just scrambling down this hill, and something must have clicked my music on in my pocket because Elvis Costello's Beyond Belief just started out of nowhere, and I screamed out loud. Like, I don't want to say a little girl because I don't want to be negative about little girls. I screamed out loud like a man who screams like you would think a woman might. Is that diplomatic enough? And then I realized it was a song, and then I turned the song off, and then I just caught my breath, put the shuffle on, and then Shine a Light by Spiritualized came on as I walked in to the setting sun out of the hike. So it had a happy ending, an uplifting ending, as a matter of fact, though there was a lot of shame involved in the hike itself. So that was an experience. And then I went to another new experience. I wanted to see if I could get fish for my cats. My cats have been enjoying these freeze-dried minnows that I bought at the pet store for too much money. And I thought, can't I just get that at some sort of Asian supermarket in bulk? Don't they have freeze-dried fish minnows that the Asians use in their meals? And I've seen that, I think. I think I've seen that in Chinatown. I know there's this place called the Seafood Market, I think. It's right over here in Eagle Rock. I believe it's a Filipino market. But I went in there, and you just have that experience. They just had tons of fish, man. All kinds of whole fish, fish heads. They had oysters and clams. They had things in tanks. They had a couple of bins of unfrozen anchovies and smelts. They had produce I had not seen before. It was just all filled with Filipino people, and I think some people from Thailand, and all the products seemed different, and it was exciting. That is the exciting thing about America, is to go into a market that services a different community than you're from and go, oh my God, look at this thing. Oh Jesus, maybe I should buy a durian. Maybe I need to try one of these. Look at the size of this thing. You open it up and it smells horrible, but it's really sweet. I've tried one. So I got some anchovies for the cats. They just scooped a big handful of raw anchovies, brought them back to three cats. None of them wanted anything to do with any of it. Monkey kicked it around, spreading the dead fish goo everywhere, stinking it up. So I threw those away, spent a dollar, threw it away. But I did get to go to the Filipino market. That's my point. Anyway, I made a mistake. This is a correction. A couple weeks ago, I mentioned being at the SAG Awards and running into Chris Sullivan from This Is Us, who was standing about 10 feet away from Robert De Niro, who was sitting down talking to somebody else. And I doubled back because I wanted to try to say hi to Robert De Niro. I didn't really want to, but I thought I should. Because I was going to pass up the opportunity because I didn't know what to say. And I walked back and I saw a guy who I thought it was Chris Sullivan. And I introduced myself, and then I asked him if he was waiting to talk to De Niro or if he was just standing here by coincidence. He goes, and he's waiting to talk to De Niro. And I'm not getting online. Yeah, but you know, it was just interesting seeing someone. I knew that that was what he was doing. But what I didn't know was that wasn't Chris Elvin. It was Mike Houston from Orange is the New Black. So I contrived something there because they both, I think they're both bearded and maybe lacking in the hair department. But nonetheless, I wanted to correct it because Mike Houston brought it to my attention on Twitter. And it was Mike Houston, not Chris Sullivan. And he didn't get to talk to him. And that's the end of that story. Now, Tracy Letts, folks, he's in Lady Bird and The Post, both of which are in theaters now. He's also a playwright, many plays. He's been in many movies, and we'll talk about that. But we also talk about talking to people, or me talking to people at award shows, and that goes somewhere. All right, this is me and Tracy Letts. How you doing, Tracy?
I'm good, Mark. How are you?
Are you adjusting?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Where's all your staff?
There's no staff. What were you led to believe? Did you just show up blindly? You had no idea what you were getting into?
I knew that you ran a podcast out of your home in
Highland Park?
Somewhere
in L.A.? Somewhere? That's all you knew?
Yeah.
I usually have a guy, but you know, there's no necessity for the guy because there, to be honest with you, I never know who's coming with who, and there's no place to put people. So I used to have a guy just to make sure that people didn't start going through my stuff so, in the house, but there's nothing in the house anymore. So,
oh, I see.
Yeah. So it's just me. The garage remains intact because I haven't moved yet. I don't know if it's nostalgia or I'm just not willing to let go. But this is the original place.
This is your gig.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Now I'm hurt that, like, you know, none of the people that you know who have been in here have called you and said, oh, Tracy, you gotta go over to Mark's house.
Nobody's done that. In fact, it kind of goes the opposite direction. Why hasn't Mark had me on? He's had all my friends on.
Did you say that?
Yeah, sure.
I've been trying to, get you on a long time ago. But I'm a fan of yours. I you know, it goes back. I like what you do. I feel like I know you. I don't know why that is.
Well,
you're one of those people.
We're roughly the same age.
We are. We've
had a long, slow, steady climb.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got a Pulitzer. So I mean, there's a big difference in our success rate. I'm hosting a podcast out of my garage and you have a Pulitzer.
Yeah, but you're on like three television shows.
But you're in movies. I mean, come on. I'm not going to do this with you. Because you won. You won that one. But you know, we took different directions.
Yeah, we did.
But we're not on a geographical level. We grew up in I grew up in New Mexico, so part of my state I think hits the tip of your state.
Does
Oklahoma
it?
Yeah. Isn't the Panhandle? Doesn't that hit the corner of New Mexico? Maybe.
See, that's Western Oklahoma. That's not my beat.
It's totally different. Yeah. No one knows what's going on in Western Oklahoma.
No, Western Oklahoma is the flat, desert part.
All right.
Eastern Oklahoma, where I come from.
The metropolis?
Eastern Oklahoma, rolling hills.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So you did grow up there. The whole.
Yeah. I was born in Tulsa and grew up in Durant, Oklahoma, a small town in southeastern Oklahoma.
So now my sense of Oklahoma is not great.
Yeah.
And
I get that.
Yeah. And, I don't know what yours is, but I mean, how did you avoid the pitfalls of Oklahoma?
Well, I didn't avoid them. I left. Yeah. That's how I avoided them. I left. But, you know, the truth is that my folks were academics. My folks were English teachers, and I grew up around English teachers and
cultured
English
folks.
Departments. And yeah, absolutely.
They were teachers at the school?
They taught at a small state college in southeastern Oklahoma, called Southeastern Oklahoma State University. That's
right
where they taught. But growing up, my dad was still pursuing his academic career, so we spent a couple of years in Champaign as he was getting his
Illinois
advanced degree. Let's see, where else? Cape Girardeau, Missouri. He taught at Southeast Missouri State for a couple of years, and a year in Copenhagen. He was a Fulbright scholar.
How old were you when you were in Copenhagen?
Just born.
Oh, so no recollection.
Yeah.
No imprint.
The folks who were from Oklahoma were were getting a little culture themselves.
Yeah. Are both your parents from Oklahoma?
Yeah, they both were. Yeah.
Wow. I just associate it with, cowboys and genocide.
Yeah. Well, the roots of the state, there are actually great progressive roots in Oklahoma.
Good.
Woody Guthrie's from Oklahoma.
Right.
Will Rogers is from Oklahoma.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
There's.
I know. I'm being poorly judgmental. It's the wrong thing. I've been to Oklahoma City. I know Wayne Coyne, who is the lead singer of the Flaming Lips.
Sure.
He's sort of a fixture there. Interesting guy. Seems like he's got an interesting world there. I'm not saying that it's not devoid of anything. I rarely meet people from Oklahoma.
Well, I did leave.
Yeah.
I left a long time ago.
I know. But it's like in you, though, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, you can see it in the Osage County play. that's what Oklahoma is to you.
Yeah. That's true.
It doesn't end well. It does not end well.
That's true. Absolutely.
So what kind of, your mother was a English?
We're in it. We're doing this. We're in the interview.
Yeah. What did you think was happening?
I don't know. It was just so seamless from, stepping into the garage to suddenly talking about Oklahoma.
You just realized it? That's why I'm known for this.
You've been doing this a long time, haven't you?
Yeah.
Damn, you're a pro.
I had the thing running and everything. Turned it on earlier. We're going. But obviously it had a lot to do with your parents. Like if you had grown up, in a rodeo town, it would have been a different life for you. But
that was
not what happened.
The folks were, they were readers.
Yeah.
The house was filled with books.
But your mom was a writer, right?
She was. Both the folks had second careers after teaching school. My mom was a writer and pursuing that for a long time while she was still teaching school. And then she got a book published and then Oprah picked it up for her book club.
Life changer.
And it was a life changer.
Mom, she's best-selling author.
Retired from teaching school. My dad took early retirement and followed me into acting. I had taken up acting at that point. He'd always been amateur actor in community theater and college theater. But he started pursuing it professionally in his 50s and made about 40 films and TV shows. Worked quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah.
You cast him, right?
I did eventually. But I mean, he had already had quite a career by that point. I mean, he's in stuff you would know, like Cast Away.
Yeah.
I know you only think of Tom Hanks on the island, but...
No, he was on the plane?
He's in the... There's a scene like a Christmas dinner, Thanksgiving dinner or something. He's the patriarch at the head of the table in Cast Away. Yeah, he did. He played a lot of sheriffs.
Oh, after Tom Hanks comes home?
Or maybe even before he goes.
Oh, really?
The last time he sees... Helen Hunt.
So wait, so your dad's out here in Hollywood?
Well, they've both passed away. Both folks have passed away. But dad, he was doing, they were making a lot of movies and TV shows in Texas at the time. So he would drive down to Austin and Dallas and Houston. He'd drive all over the place to go to these auditions and book jobs.
He did it.
Yeah, he did.
He became like a 2 or 3 line character actor.
He did, or even sometimes a little more than that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
He was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have put him in Osage if he wasn't really good.
He was in the
really
original
good.
Cast of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was he in the film, too?
He's not in the film.
That was Sam Shepard played his part?
That's correct.
Sam Shepard. You like Sam Shepard.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, so we'll get back to Shepard, because I felt like there was... I try to figure out... Like when I was in college or when I was watching plays and thinking about writing plays and being in plays myself, I think we might have had the same trajectory had I not taken the easier route in just being funny for people. Like had I had the confidence to
stand up, that's a real easy route.
Yeah, but it's very impulsive. You have a lot of control. It's very immediate and you don't have to do much work if you do it right. Right. But to write a play, you got to believe that.
I thought we weren't going to compare like this, Mark.
No, we're not. No, I've already admitted.
we have both staggered blindly from one gig to the next for our entire adult lives.
Right, and we're both nominated for SAG Awards. I'll meet you there. I did it. I got a nomination. I did.
Are you nominated for a SAG Award?
Yeah.
You're there tomorrow night.
I am.
What are you nominated for?
For my, I'm best male in a comedy for Glow.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
It came to me late, the acting thing. It just, it was always there, but it was never.
That's great.
But
are you going to win?
I don't think so. I find that hard to believe that this late in the game.
You think you've got a chance? Because if you didn't think you had a chance, your answer would have been, no fucking way am I going
to
win that award.
Well, I'm trying to be transparent here. My ego would like to think I could win, but I don't know if I can win. I'm up against the Will and Grace guy and Larry David. And
write a speech.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why don't we do it together? Do you have to thank, do you thank your agents for everything? I thought maybe I'd just thank the writers and my co-stars and talk about, I'm happy I bought a suit.
Acknowledge the other nominees.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
I'll write that down. Hey,
you got to write it, though. These people who get up and say, I didn't think I could win, so I didn't write anything. Yeah. It's like, well, you put on the fucking suit.
Right.
You stood in the line with everybody.
Yeah.
You sat at the table.
Yeah, you should have.
You really didn't think there was a possibility.
Throw a couple things together. Have you written something?
No, because we're nominated for Ensemble, so I wouldn't be the one talking.
I'm nominated for that, too, for Glow.
Nice.
Yeah.
But we're in different categories, right? We won't be. Oh, yeah, because yours is TV.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fine. You had to find a way. Just shut me down. All right. We're on the same level there for a minute. And now I'm on television. I've seen you on television.
I'm on TV too. Sure.
But let's get back to my original point, which was you're doing the noble, literate, creative pursuit. You're a playwright.
Yeah, no, it wasn't like that. I went to Chicago.
What, that old?
I 20 years old.
And now, what had you done before then, acting-wise?
I had gone to Dallas for a couple of years with my little headshot and resume, trying to get work.
Did someone misdirect you? Did you?
Well, it was close to home.
I want to be an actor. I'm going to Dallas.
It was 100 miles from home. I could go home on the weekends and my mom would do my laundry.
So this is before you're like 20. This is in your late teens. You go to Dallas.
I didn't go to college. I went to Dallas, headshot and resume, and tried to work.
Dallas, man. I got no sense of that town. But that was like, so it still had a profile. It had some money still, Dallas, at that time.
In the 80s, they made a lot of movies and TV shows in Dallas. They were touting it as the Third Coast. They built this big goddamn soundstage out at Las Colinas. And every year, there was a Places in the Heart or a...
Right. They must have given a tax break.
Tender Mercies. Every year, kind of stuff was rolling out.
What a great movie that is.
Yeah. There was some great stuff happening there. So I went there, but, I didn't work. I couldn't get arrested. I worked in the theater a little bit. Fringe Theater in Dallas.
Like, what? Really? Fringe Theater in Dallas?
Yeah.
Like Black Box Theater? Doing what? Doing Beckett?
When You Coming Back, Red Rider by Mark Medoff. The Glass Menagerie at Mesquite Community Theater.
Ooh. How was that production?
It's all right.
Yeah. But you had no training at that time?
No,
you didn't?
No, not
you just
any,
winging it?
Pretty much. I mean, I had done a year when I was a senior in high school.
Yeah.
We could take classes at the college where my folks taught. So I did that and did some shows.
Right.
But yeah, pretty much winging it.
So Dallas didn't no show business dreams didn't pan out in Dallas.
No, and a girlfriend of mine moved to Chicago,
and
I didn't take the cue, so I followed her up to Chicago.
That's always what I'm sure it's what she wanted. I'm sure she was thrilled, like, oh, Tracy.
Strange we're no longer together, but I followed her up to Chicago.
You're the guy that stalked her. I knew that guy. That's what she'll be saying at the award show when she's watching on TV. That's that guy. Do you know her still?
I know who she is,
okay.
But we don't keep in touch.
Not since the restraining order?
So I went to Chicago. Yeah. I fell in love with the city. I fell in love with the theater scene in Chicago. I'd never seen anything like it.
How did it start? Because I just talked to Lori. Like, it's sort of been a mystery to me. How Steppenwolf started, this mythic place of, anger and creativity. And, and then when I heard that you were kind of part of that, I'm like, well, that makes sense. He's a furious man that writes dark things. And, but I never got the whole history that, that they were just kids, but you were a little later, I think.
I'm later. They're all those kids are about 10 years older than me.
So when you get there, do you seek that out? Are you just like, I'm in Chicago. Was it like, do I go to Second City and watch the clowns or do I go watch the serious shit?
That's right. It's running around auditioning for different theaters. There's a great theater culture there. There's a great...
Great live show culture.
Oh, my God. Yeah, there's 200 storefront theaters and they're all doing great, interesting work and they're all doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing it to get famous.
So this is the late 80s?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Vital. Still vital.
And the first show I did in Chicago was The Glass Menagerie.
Again.
Again.
You already knew the lines. Same part?
Same part.
Oh, lucky you.
And at Steppenwolf. I did it at Steppenwolf.
God.
It was the part of their, you know, the shows for high school kids.
Oh, so you were like 19, 20? Like
I was early 20s, yeah.
So you went in for the young people auditions? Or
pretty much.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Crashed the young people auditions.
And who was directing it? Anybody famous?
Francis Guinan.
Yeah.
A very good actor who was in August Osage County, the original cast.
Uh-huh.
He was directing it, and he cast me in the show.
And that began your relationship with Steppenwolf?
Yeah. Though, I mean, that was 88.
Yeah.
And they didn't add me to the company till 2002. So there's a long...
Well, they really made you work for it.
About as long as they made anybody ever work for it. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So what do you do? So what? How are you persisting then? So you get cast at 20 in the Tennessee Williams play at Steppenwolf. So you're like, I'm in. And then what happens?
Then I'm not in. And so I have to go work other places. And I worked, you know, again, Chicago is a great theater town. And
right.
I was meeting a lot of people, working up at the Next Theater in Evanston, which is where I met Michael Shannon.
When
he was 16 and I was 25. We became friends. Yeah.
He was six. He was that young. I can't remember. Like he was very, he was kind of intense and aggravated about things when I talked to him. I think he probably told me.
That doesn't sound like Mike.
I know. It's crazy, right? I was totally surprised by it. I had thought he'd be chipper when he came over and full of focus.
He's still a dear friend of mine. He's a lovely guy.
I love talking to him.
Yeah.
And I just saw him in The Shape of Water. I thought he was great. He's always great.
Yeah, he's always great.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw him in your movie. I watched that because I talked to Friedkin in here, but we're not there yet.
Okay.
I want to know. Friedkin came in here and talked for 2.5 hours. And he had... There was a theme to it.
Oh, like, yeah. No, he's...
There was a through line that you didn't realize until the end of the conversation that he just laid it out. It was fate.
Yeah.
Fate was the through line.
Billy can... Hurricane Billy. There's a reason they call him Hurricane Billy. He's inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah. You just sit there and like, oh, my God. And everything's connected with him. You know what I mean? There's a lot of connections.
Yeah. Also a dear friend of mine. Lovely man.
I'm
lovely
not saying
gentleman.
Anything bad about the guy. He's one of the best episodes. Is my tone coming out wrong? these were impressive conversations.
Great. Good.
I got a little concerned with Michael because I didn't know if he was going to fall into himself and I wouldn't know how to fish him out. But I kept him out here.
Well, I met him when he was 16 and I was 25. He played my son, even though there's 9 years difference.
In
but
what?
I've always looked a little older. A couple of one acts called Fun and Nobody by Howard Korder.
Yeah.
At the Next Lab Theater. And
who was involved in that? Anybody who came out of that? Was that a theater company?
The Next was a company in Evanston for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And the Next Lab was the brainchild of a guy named Dexter Bullard, a great theater director in Chicago. It was basically a classroom that he painted black, seated about 40 people.
Yeah.
There was a lot of really good work that happened in that space. Mike and I did Fun and Nobody, and then that's where Killer Joe started.
How did that start? Like...
Well, I found myself with some downtime as an actor in Chicago, and I
and you're 22?
26.
26?
Yeah.
So this is like years after The Glass Menagerie.
Yeah, a few years
And you've been
after.
Kicking around.
Yeah.
And you meet Shannon. And
yeah.
Kindred spirits. This guy seems to have a chip on his shoulder. Me too.
Yeah, yeah. All that's true.
Yeah.
So I wrote this play, this kind of horror noir play, and we put it up at the Next Lab, 40-seat house.
Yeah.
And it was did really well.
It did.
Very well, yeah.
There was an intensity to it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But what inspired that? I mean, why that story? Were you experimenting, or was it coming from, like, I always, because, like, I thought about, like, I didn't, you remember the movie Joe with Peter Boyle?
Sure.
It's a horrifying movie.
Yeah.
But your thing, the layers of it, it's pretty relentless and pretty awful.
Yeah.
In a good way.
You ever seen it in the theater?
I have not.
See, it's different. It's a different experience.
Well, I
want to
see it. I can't wait. I didn't, was it out here?
It was, yeah. It played out here.
When?
Oh, well, I don't know. A few years ago.
Look, I saw Osage in New York with Estelle Parsons. Does that mean anything?
It means a lot.
All right.
It has nothing to do with whether or not you saw
Killer Joe. I want to see a high school production of Killer Joe.
It's, it had a certain intensity. And
was that the first play you wrote?
Yeah.
And what, now you just sat down and did it you'd done enough plays that you sort of knew what needed to be, you know, what you just winged it?
I don't know. I had an idea for a story. I read a story in the newspaper. I was like, oh, this might make an interesting play. I wonder if you could tell a story like this on stage.
Yeah.
You know, Chicago, we were known for
pushing the envelope.
Yeah, smash mouth,
yeah,
in your face, whatever the hell,
yeah,
cliche, right, you want to use.
Sure, sure.
We were known for that stuff, so it was written in that mold.
Yeah, the sort of Malkovich fury that
was
hung over Chicago.
I was a troubled, angry.
What were you
person.
Pissed off about?
I have no, don't even, I can't even answer the question.
Really?
I don't know, yeah.
Because I thought you would be angrier, you know, like, and then like.
You mean now?
Why, but we get old, yeah.
Oh, no, I'm very old now.
52.
Yeah.
I'm 54.
Yeah.
And I was angrier young as I, when I was younger too.
Sure.
Like really bad.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yelling at people.
Isn't it silly?
Yeah, it is silly in retrospect.
Yeah.
I was all worked up about a lot of things that don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
And like, I can track a lot of the anger, you know, but a lot of it, I don't know how, you know, valid it is or what, you know, if it's really, there's any way to empathize with my entitled anger.
Yeah.
Do you find that you were angry about like real shit?
I don't know. I was drunk, you know. I got sober about 3 weeks after Killer Joe premiered.
Forever?
Yeah.
Really? So you were fucked up?
Yeah.
And you did it the old school way?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Still?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Me too. 18 years.
24 years.
All right, see, there we go again. You know, maybe we were on the same thing.
Similar track.
Similar, yeah, yeah. It's got to jump on me on that one. I had a little more experimenting to do, as they say in the racket. So, all right. So you got sober. Like, so, but whoa, man, how do you, like, it always amazes me when people like hit the wall in their 20s.
Yeah.
You just knew? You're like, oh, this can't
yeah,
go.
Yeah. I was, you know, hurting a lot of people, hurting myself.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Just got to a point where I mean, thank God, you know.
Yeah.
Did
you used to smoke too?
Hell yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You did it all. Marlboro Reds?
Yeah, I smoked Marlboro Reds,
yeah,
among other things.
All out.
Yeah, sure.
And Chicago's a fucking meat and drinking town.
Yes, it is.
It's just like everywhere. You just walk down the street and there should be signs that say, cancer available here. Heart disease. Come on in.
It's true.
End your life in here.
Yeah.
But I love that place. So I grew to like Chicago.
Yeah, it's a great city.
So you sobered up, and then how did that go? Did you, you know, did you adjust to it? Took a while, right?
Yeah, it's a process.
Yeah.
Process I'm still in, right? And some fashion.
Sure, sure, sure. The obsession is no longer with you,
right.
but whatever you were hiding.
Whatever that thing is that makes you become that person to begin with, right?
Yeah,
you're still
there.
That person.
Yeah,
so.
It's awful. Itchy, itchy soul. Aggravated. So what happens with Killer Joe?
Well, everybody in town panned it except for Richard Christensen in the Chicago Tribune,
yeah,
who championed it, so it became a big fat hit.
Wow.
And ran, I mean, you know.
And you moved it to a bigger place?
We didn't immediately move it to a bigger place. We ran there for about 8 months, and then we raised the money to take the show to the Edinburgh Festival in
Fringe
Scotland.
Fest?
Yes.
Oh, you did that. I did that once. I'll never do it again.
We took it to the Traverse Theater, Fringe Fest, and man.
Killed?
Yeah, it just killed. And
wow.
From there, it went to the Bush Theater in London, which is a great pub theater in London. And from there, it went to the West End and played in the West End for 4 months.
Well, they love American stuff, and that is so brutally fucking bloodily American.
Yeah.
It just, they must have been like, this is what it's like.
They loved it. And the timing of it, there in the early 90s, mid-90s when it hit, the timing was really good.
Who originated the role?
In the original production, Michael Shannon, Paul Dillon,
uh-huh,
very fine actor, played Killer Joe. Shauna Franks, Holly Wontuck, Mark Nelson.
Yeah.
And then we replaced Paul with a guy named Eric Winsenried when we went to London.
So that was it. That you were a big playwright. Boom. Out of the gate.
Yeah, I was. I didn't kind of realize that until I went to London, where the show was happening. I was like, oh, shit, this is kind of blown up a little bit over here,
some of the real deal. You're not even 30 and you're the real deal.
And there was, we became friendly with a little theater company over there, the Gate Theater in Notting Hill, and they said, will you write another one for us with your same group of people?
Yeah.
So I wrote Bug. I wrote it with Mike in mind.
Yeah.
We, again, put together a similar kind of cast, and the play actually premiered in London at the Gate Theater.
Another festering American play.
Yeah. Written while sober, though.
Yeah. Yeah. What odd. You know, because that one,
they, or not.
No,
or
that, that actually makes sense, right?
Right.
Yeah, just coming out of it.
Yeah.
When everything becomes clear. I see it all now, man.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was continuing to work in theater in Chicago, and Steppenwolf came calling around this time, and they put me in a play called Picasso at the Le Panagile by Steve Martin.
Uh-huh.
Which was a big hit for us, and we brought it to Los Angeles.
For Steppenwolf.
Yeah. And ran at the, what is now the Geffen Playhouse. Ran there for a year.
So, but they didn't let you in the company yet. You got two hit plays. You're an established playwright. You're like 30 years old. You're sober. And they're like, you want to do a part in the clown's play?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And who was running fucking Steppenwolf at that time? And I'm not trying to bait you into getting retroactively aggravated for them making you wait.
I'm not actually aggravated about it.
I know.
Or
why would you be?
I might have been then, but I don't recall it.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
See, that's age. That's age helping you out.
Yeah. I'm not cursed with these things you people call memories.
Yes, they're the worst. It's fun when they leave. I've lived in several different cities. When people walk up to me, they're like, hey, Mark. I'm like, what time frame? Which city? Give me an era, if you could. And did I do anything bad?
Yeah. What did I do to you?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's always a good question. So, all right. So you do the Picasso play. Is that a good play?
That's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were a fun guy now that you're sober?
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a good gig. I got to, you know, join the union. I went equity with
that
show.
Oh, you came out here.
Came out here and joined the union and had my first real experience in Los Angeles.
What happened that time?
Not much.
No?
No.
Did you get an agent out here or any of that?
Yeah, you know, I went and I did a home improvement.
See, now there's the question. Now, what happened that day? Like, here you are. West End, you know, two plays, Steppenwolf, you're a respected literary man. And you're like, you go meet an agent. And they're like, hey, you know, we got a thing. We're going to send you out on the thing. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. Going on home improvement.
Yeah. And you're like,
and I did it.
Of course you did it. It was, oh, is that how we're going to, that's how.
No, it was. It was totally, I mean, it was a nice little part.
Yeah.
And Tim Allen was a sweetheart.
Yeah.
He was a real sweetheart to all the people on the show.
It was a big show.
It was sweet paycheck for me. I'd never made a paycheck like that before.
See, that's it, right? That's the thing. Yeah. Full character arc or just
I had one nice scene. I had one nice scene playing a kind of eccentric character with his wife.
Uh-huh.
With, I can't remember her name.
And that got you into the union and, you know, everything.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
And did it wet your whistle? Were you like, I'm coming out here. I'm going to do more episodic television.
I didn't really think of it like that, though that's exactly what happened.
Uh-huh.
I moved, I went back to Chicago.
Yeah.
And did some more plays in Chicago. And then me and my girlfriend in Chicago moved out here.
Yeah.
In 97, in the fall of 97. And I did 4 years in Los Angeles from 97 to 2001.
So you did a few plays acting in Chicago. You move out with your girlfriend who did not become your wife. Or no.
She passed away.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right. She passed away about 4 months after we moved out here.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What happened?
She had a congenital heart condition. She had a stroke. 32 years old. We were both 32.
That's horrible.
Yes, it was. It is. And coming up on the 20-year anniversary of that, I'm very conscious of that anniversary. Yeah.
Of her death?
Yeah, hell yeah.
Oh, my God. So you had to deal with that.
Yeah. And I stayed. I stayed in Los Angeles. I came out here. We lived out here for 4 months.
Yeah.
She died. And then I don't know. I just didn't, like, going back to Chicago didn't make sense to me. So
but
I stayed.
Did you have friends out here?
Yeah. I had quite a few friends from Chicago who had moved out here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because like this can be a very lonely, isolating place.
It's
lonely
and isolating even when you have friends out here.
Yeah. So you're dealing with this shock and grief and like, you know, mortality thing?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So I come out here and I did, you know, more of that stuff. I did a Seinfeld episode. I'm in the Festivus episode of Seinfeld, right?
Right.
I did I did Profiler.
Yeah.
I did, you know.
Yeah.
The District.
You're working. Yeah. You're getting little parts. You're
getting little parts. Doing little guest spots.
And like, who are your friends? Are they, were you surrounded by successful people when you were out here? Like,
I was surrounded by really talented people, some of whom were working, some not. But no names that are going to make you go, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, Mike was starting to work quite a bit as an actor, though certainly I don't think people would have recognized him walking down the street.
It's so, like, to me, like, you know, there's something impressive yet heartbreaking about, you know, the evolution of it. You know, you both ended up great, you know, but to think of, like, you know, like you and Michael Shannon, people who do very, you know, specific and amazing work, you know, kind of like hitting the fucking, you know, the streets to go do little bit parts. I'm glad you made it out. I'm glad you got to where you got.
Thanks.
I mean,
Nick Offerman too. I mentioned him only because he's been on your show.
Yeah.
Nick, you know, that little production we did of Killer Joe in the next lab, Nick built the set.
He likes to build things, man.
Nick built the trailer.
He's got a whole shop out here.
Yeah.
He makes,
he's a very talented guy.
Yeah. But he likes making furniture. I think that's what he does now. Almost. I don't know if he's, I think he's
kind of, out of the business.
I think it might be. He might be just making furniture. And I tell you, Tracy, when I hear stories like that, I'm like, good for you.
Yeah, no shit.
You got out without the shame and you're okay with yourself. You got out and you don't consider yourself a failure. Congratulations. You did it. That's how I feel sometimes. So what broke you out here? I mean, because, you know, this is a 4-year period of time in between, you know, writing two great plays, then you do a Seinfeld, a Profiler, a Home Improvement, you experience a horrendous loss. And what was it, what made you go write a Pulitzer Prize winning play?
A couple of different things. I got in another relationship that went south. Yeah. You know, which is not.
You didn't drink either, did you?
I didn't drink.
That's what we forgot that part. That must have helped you get through.
I didn't drink. So I got in a relationship that also went south, and at the same time, I was just finding that those gigs I was doing, they weren't exactly
fulfilling.
They weren't feeding the soul.
Imagine.
I had somebody. There was a show they made out here. You might recall it, called VIP with Pamela Anderson.
Huh. I kind of recall. I don't know what it was.
Follow up to Baywatch.
Yeah.
I don't know. Pamela Anderson was a spy or assassin or some shit.
Right.
And this thing was very popular, not in this country.
Yeah.
Right? It's popular elsewhere.
Probably everywhere elsewhere.
So the residuals were great.
Yeah.
If you got a VIP, I had buddies who, if they booked a VIP, it was like that thing paid off like a slot machine.
And you were on it?
I was not. I had a couple of buddies who booked it.
Yeah.
And I got jealous of them.
Yeah.
And that was the moment where I went, oh, fuck. VIP.
Yeah.
It was never supposed to be about this.
Right. So when you heard they got it, you're like, fuck, man.
Yeah.
How'd you get that? And you're like, what's happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to go write a Pulitzer Prize winning play.
So I got in my car and I drove back to Chicago.
Yeah.
The first play I did when I got back was a revival of Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, that's great.
And it was a great
play. Which guy did you play?
I played Williamson, who runs The Office.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Spacey plays him in the movie.
Yeah, right.
Which I've never seen. Pasquazi, you know Pasquazi, you guys. He played Ricky Roma. It was a great production.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my reentry into Chicago, 2001.
And were they all happy you were back?
Yeah.
Like, that's the great thing about those, like, about cities like Austin and Chicago. When people come back battered from L.A. or Nashville, they're like, come on.
Yeah.
Have a seat. Welcome to the club.
That's exactly right. Welcome home. And in fact, a lot of my friends were like, why'd you come back? Seemed like you were doing pretty good out there. Like, no. VIP.
I could tell you the story, the VIP story.
So Steppenwolf asked me to join the company.
Oh.
A lot of their people had left, right? A lot of that original group, they had all left for Los Angeles and New York.
Did they set it up like that? Is that how they offered you the job? Hey, we're out of guys.
Because it came with a condition when they added me. They said, we want you to stay in town.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, I'm not looking to leave.
Oh, that's great.
So they said, stay here in Chicago and we'll put you in the company. I said, great.
What does it mean to be in the company? Does that mean that they will give you work? consistently?
Yeah.
Basically, like, you know, we're going to find plays for you to do and keep you eating.
And, you
know, if you commit to staying here,
you'll be as involved as you want to be. Right?
And who was running it then?
Martha Levy.
Uh-huh.
The late Martha Levy passed away and this, last year.
Oh. Was this after they moved to the bigger space, obviously?
Yeah.
Now, did you ever start a theater troupe? Did you ever start a group?
Yeah, I started a couple of groups.
What were they?
Small, short-lived. A company called Point Theater Company in Chicago, and also a little improv group. I didn't start it. I was part of an improv group there called Bang Bang with Michael Shannon and Paul Dillon and... a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Chicago people.
Yeah. Was it? I think that it wasn't Amy Pates in that?
Amy Pates.
Pates, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was on an episode of my show. She did a lot of work out here.
She did. She's very good.
She did an episode of Marin. However, she's great.
Yeah, she is.
All right, so those didn't stick, obviously. But it was an improv. So what kind of improv? Like comedy improv?
Though we were all people from the theater. We were trying to bring some of our theater stuff into the world of improvisational
comedy. Like Second City. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're like, improvs would be derailed with crying and violence?
Yes. Yes, that's a pretty good description.
That's how we're going to do comedy?
I can say that certainly some of the worst and some of the best things I've ever seen in a theater took place while doing Bang Bang.
But improv's pretty freeing, though. It's got to be helpful. I mean, you're learning how to act during through all this, too. You're winging it.
Yeah.
You weren't ever given any real guidance, were you?
Right. And then when I went back in 2001, Dave and TJ started up. You know, David Pasquese and TJ Jagodowski, they started their two-man improv show.
Uh-huh.
Some of the best improv I've ever seen, the best improv I've ever seen in my life. And occasionally they would ask me to come and sit in with them, and it was great.
For an improv jam?
Yeah, they'd just get bored.
Right.
They'd be like, we're bored. Can you come and...
You like improvising?
I love it with those guys because they're so fucking good.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't fuck it up.
Yeah, yeah.
I could only fuck it up so bad.
Right. But it amazes me sort of like because when I talked to Lori about Steppenwolf, none of them had any. There was no guru on like all those improvisers in Chicago had Del Close around,
right.
But like with Steppenwolf, and it seems with you that you sort of found your way into the acting gig.
Yeah,
it wasn't like there was no guru, there was no Buddha, there was no this is how you do it.
Right,
that's kind of fascinating.
That's right.
Does it fascinate you, or do you think you cheated?
Cheated.
No, I mean, in the sense that, like, there's a real racket in training. You know what I mean? That usually, whether it's a teacher or somebody that, gave you some tips.
Oh, I think training probably would have given me so many shortcuts that I had to take the long way around to figure out, I don't knock training just because I didn't have it.
Right. Yeah.
There was no guru necessarily. Right. I mean, what there were a lot of great actors around me, and we were all challenging each other.
Right.
Everybody was challenging each other to up your game.
And yes.
That was true of Chicago then. It's true of Chicago now.
It's the second time I've heard it. You know, it's like that. That's what it was.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you got?
Yeah.
Let's go.
That's right.
And so, all right, so now you're a member of Steppenwolf.
I knew Del, by the way.
You did.
He stepped into Picasso at the Le Panagile for a while. I got a chance to do the show with Del for a while.
Yeah.
Pick his brain about, some of the old stories and stuff. No, he was just a lot of fun.
Yeah? I have no sense of him. I had to learn about that whole scene. Like, I come from the stand-up history. So, like, through this show and through, because there's been a big shift in comedy and show business, out of stand-up-centric shows to sort of, like, sketch performers. And Chicago kind of, overtook New York in terms of its importance in modern comedy history.
Interesting.
Well, it was always sort of there, with SNL and the Lampoon people, but whatever. But I didn't know much about it. And this Del Close, he was a real Buddha, that guy.
Yeah, he really was.
So you're in Steppenwolf now. So you're working, you're in Chicago.
And so now,
not drinking.
As a playwright, I'd had two shows.
Yeah.
And I wrote a third show, Man from Nebraska, it was called. And so suddenly I had a little bigger.
What was that one about? I don't know that play.
Man from Nebraska is a play about a middle-aged guy from Nebraska who wakes up. He's an insurance salesman, kind of a boring guy, who wakes up in the middle of the night and realizes he doesn't believe in God and starts a kind of. leaves home and looks for himself a little bit. That's what it was about. And it was 2003, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow. They tell you that, huh?
Yeah, you know what? They don't tell you before you lose it.
Right.
They call you and they say, congratulations, you lost.
Yeah. It was close, man. Yeah. It was close.
I didn't even know I was up
for. Yeah. Who won that year?
I know this. I Am My Own Wife.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Who wrote that?
Doug Wright.
Uh-huh.
Very gifted playwright from Dallas, Texas.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were like, I should have stayed in Dallas. I knew I shouldn't have left Dallas.
And then, so I was doing two or three shows a year in Chicago.
Acting.
I mean, you know, Mark, when I left Los Angeles and went back to Chicago, I really took a vow of poverty, right? I knew what I had left in Chicago. You can't make any money in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so I knew I was going back to act in the theater. I knew I was giving up on, you know, that big VIP money.
Mm-hmm.
But
and that stature.
But it was just like, I was so much happier. I had been so much happier in Chicago doing plays.
Oh, this
I was
this,
out in Los Angeles.
Yes, this is a soul-crushing dump, just a fucking soul-crushing spiritual garbage hole. This is what
that's one way to say it.
Look, if you don't have to stay here, Jesus, get out. So just filled with people rationalizing
that
why
that family with where all the kids are chained up, is that near here?
It's right across the street. Didn't you see that house? I knew those kids. I knew there was something wrong. It's weird. You know what I mean?
Did you read that the pets were really well fed? All the dogs were really well fed.
Yeah. I think it's time for a new play. You got
it's too upsetting.
That's too upsetting. Have you seen Killer Joe?
So, and then I wrote August Osage County, which changed my life, which was...
Now, when you're doing that, writing that great play, like, because to me, like, you know, I felt the presence of, you know, O'Neill, Tennessee Williams, Sam Shepard a little bit, in the sense of, like, you know, what you were embarking on, classic family tragedy, really, right?
Yeah.
Now, like, who were your models? Did you just... It must have taken a certain amount of time and structure and decision-making and running bits and pieces. What's the process of writing a Pulitzer Prize-winning play like that?
It's long, slow process.
Did I name any of your heroes?
You named them all. I mean, they are all my heroes. You know, it's based on a true story. My grandfather committed suicide by drowning when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
My grandmother descended into years of downer addiction.
Yeah.
You know, put my mother especially, but my whole family through hell. So it's based very much on that, you know, something that had stuck with me for 30 years, right? I mean, your grandfather drowns himself.
Did you know him?
Yeah, I knew him. Knew him well. You know, when I first started writing it, I called my dad to ask him some details. I just had forgotten a lot of the stuff. You know, I was 10 years old.
Right.
And he was very helpful with all that. And then he said, why are you writing about this?
Yeah.
And I said, well, it seems like the stuff of drama and the events from that time have haunted me for 30 years. And he said, they have? Never occurred to her.
Well, yeah, but it's wild, right? When your grandfather ends his own life and you know that at 10, that's got to, you know, that's a big hole.
Well, one of the things that happens in August Osage County, right, is parents take their eye off the ball.
Yeah, right.
You know, my folks were great parents. I loved my folks. We were very close.
Yeah.
But that was a time when, you know, circumstances being what they are, they probably took their eye off the ball.
Probably parenting? Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say they took their eye off the ball.
You got to walk a kid through that. Why Grandpa killed himself?
Yeah, I mean just the mental images of my grandfather underwater. You know, it's such a lonely way to die. You know,
just floating there.
Yeah, in the middle of the night, takes a boat out in the middle of the night and jumps into the middle of the fucking lake in the middle of the night.
And but with no weights on him or nothing.
Yeah, just chooses not to swim. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's commitment.
Yeah.
And now, is the emotional elements and relationship dynamics, are they sort of true to life from that play?
So, you know, some of it's created, some of it's borrowed, some of it's from real life.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the process of putting all that together is long, slow, painstaking, kind of boring, actually. I mean, boring to describe.
But did you have a sense of, like, you obviously had a sense of structure
sure.
from doing plays.
Sure.
You know, like, you know, act breaks and, yeah. you know, this, and you knew you were writing a big three-act thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with a lot of heaviness.
Well, I had the story.
Yeah.
And then the question becomes, what's the right container for that story?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the big American family drama is the right container for that story, right?
Going back to O'Neill and
yeah.
and Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Buried Child, kind of.
All that stuff.
Yeah, the dad stuff.
All
yeah.
that stuff. And, well, you know, there are little reflections of those plays throughout August, Osage County, and other stuff, too. You
right.
know, that's all intentional. I hope it is. Somebody told me once I had stolen something from The Little Foxes by yeah. Lillian Hellman. I had never even read The Little Foxes.
It's funny how people are just like, you know, the talentless scavenge for reasons to attack people with talent.
It's yeah,
what,
well.
It's what they do.
Yeah.
I heard someone use that word. You think you're so smart? It's like, what do you do? Don't worry about me. I did a thing once. So, well, that's a, like, because it was a mind-blowing thing. I didn't really feel like it was, you know, hacking off anybody else. I thought it was its own thing, and in that it was this horrible family drama. But I could feel that arc, the way that, you know, that the way it ends with, what is it, just two characters.
Yeah.
After you just subtract people.
Yeah.
One way or the other, people yeah. are subtracted.
Right.
That there's that weird emotional desolation, you know, that it ends with an indigenous person, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where it ends. Yeah. Look what you did. You came and went. Yeah. Well, I mean, with Shepard in the movie, you wrote the script for the movie?
I did.
Did you have anything to do with casting?
No.
Oh. Now,
I mean, you know.
Were you on set?
I was there for the table read. I was there first day.
Did you talk to Sam? Had you talked to Sam before?
I had never talked to Sam before. It was the only day I ever spent with Sam. And I have to say that at the table read, he was the only one I was nervous about.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Because your dad had played it.
Yeah. And I wasn't, I just nervous to be around him. I mean, I wasn't starstruck by Meryl or, you know,
right,
Mr.
Sure.
Clooney or.
Well, you've been through some shit by now, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But Sam, Sam could have hurt me, yeah. right?
Yeah.
If Sam had said the wrong thing at the wrong moment, he would have hurt me. And he didn't do that. In fact, in the moment that he might have done that, he actually did the right thing and said some really lovely, gracious things about my piece in front of everybody. It was like, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget him for that.
He could have hurt you.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
By not saying anything.
Sure.
I mean,
that would have hurt in a way.
There's
but
a lot of projection could have happened. You, right. you were just a vulnerable, no matter what you could have done to defend yourself, there was nothing you could have done. It was, you just, yeah, and it worked out.
Right.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
I had a hard time going through that story just now. I'm all choked up that it worked out. Holy shit. So he liked the piece.
He did like the piece. Yeah, he liked it a lot.
He got kind of sparse later in terms of his writing.
Yeah, I know. And when he died, you look at the list and it's like, it's over 50 plays.
So many.
I've written 9.
What's holding you up?
It's hard. It's fucking hard.
And acting is easier.
Well, sometimes, oftentimes. You're doing something really hard, yes, acting's easy.
But I thought the film was good. I thought they did a good job with it. Who directed that?
John Wells.
Did you like it?
It was complicated.
Mm.
It was complicated.
But it wasn't a disaster.
No,
it
wasn't a disaster.
It's always
and I'm
be
glad
difficult.
It's out there. I'm glad it's out there. But I had a hard time with the producers. I had a hard time with Harvey.
You worked with him?
Well, I wouldn't call it that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we he was on the project.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it would be like to have a play become a movie.
It shouldn't happen. It really shouldn't happen.
Well, then why'd you let Friedkin do 2 of them?
Well, you know, I'll tell you why. Because I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and I didn't have access to Streetcar Named Desire
yeah.
and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or Shakespeare.
Right.
My access to that shit was through the movies.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been able to see that stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's some kid in southeastern Oklahoma right now who's, you know, home watching Killer Joe.
Yeah.
And it speaks to him.
Right. That's true.
And Bug in August, Osage County. They can't afford to go to New York and pay $100 for a theater ticket to see it on Broadway.
Or wait for it even to come locally.
That's right. And, yeah, Killer Joe and Bug are not playing locally
in
southeastern Oklahoma.
And so, like, no one's doing them in high school.
So that's why.
Yeah.
I've always felt like, you know, they're it's not the same experience.
Right.
When I say it's complicated, that for me is really the
right.
That's why it's complicated, because I don't think films should be made out of plays.
Or they can't do what theater does.
No.
But I thought that Friedkin knew that. I think he respected it, you know, and I think he tried to do something.
They're William Friedkin movies.
Yeah.
You know, which is great. I'm thrilled that there are a couple of William Friedkin movies
that are
based on
play.
My plays.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled about that. They're not the play. They're
Tully's
movies.
Yeah, and like Altman tried to do that. He tried to do it in a way that would honor the theater, and it never quite works.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
The experience is different.
Yeah.
In a theater, you have to lean forward in your seat. You have to pay attention. You have to tune your ear.
Yeah, and
you know,
shit might happen.
You've done studies recently that show that audiences... hearts are actually syncing up during live plays.
Really? Is that
yes,
true?
Yes, that's true. That's an actual thing.
Huh.
There's something about the group experience watching a play that's very different than watching them. There's a reason you can watch a movie in your basement or your, you know, there's a reason you can eat popcorn and watch a movie. You can't
sure.
eat popcorn and watch a play.
No, because everyone be mad at you.
Well, it also just requires a certain investment on the part
of the audience. I'm fascinated. I don't go to enough, but when I do, I'm always like immediately emotionally all jangled.
Yeah.
Because like the whole space of it, that you can see people spitting and feel them breathing and hear the feet dragging on the boards.
Isn't
and like,
it fantastic?
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It's great. And it shouldn't be... it should be required. Not like, you know, like, ugh, is it a good production of that?
Yeah.
Yes. Who's in it? Oh, I haven't seen him in 20 years. Right. From TV?
Right.
But so you're working on a play?
What?
Are you working on writing one?
Right now?
Yeah.
I've had 3 plays come out in the last 2 years.
What are you yelling at me for? I didn't know that.
I'm not yelling. I got a microphone.
It's my mistake. It's my mistake. You've had 3 plays come out in the last 3 years, new ones.
Yeah.
And I missed them.
Well, they haven't been in New York. They've only been in Chicago, where I still live and where I'm still a member of Steppenwolf Theater.
So are they done? Are you workshopping? Are they, you
they're
know,
done.
They're
they
going
were, had
to Broadway?
Full productions. The first of those 3 is called Mary Page Marlowe.
Yeah.
And it is going to be at the Second Stage Theater in New York this summer.
Oh, good.
The second of those plays is called Linda Vista, and I think it's going to be here in Los Angeles
yeah.
in about a year.
Yeah.
The third of those plays is called The Minutes, and we're trying to get it to Broadway. We're not there yet, but we're trying.
So, like, that's amazing. So you're a playwright. You keep going.
I've been a playwright for a long time, man.
I know that, dude, but I see you in movies. You're funny. You're doing the thing. You know, you're
well,
doing
here's
some
what
comedy.
Happened, see?
You're doing some serious. You're mixing it up. Become so, an American character actor.
Now we have to get back to the timeline. So August Osage County happens, and then I wrote Superior Donuts, which was also on.
I auditioned for that TV
Broadway.
Show. Yeah.
Did you audition for the TV show?
Yeah, I didn't quite. I turned it down.
Oh, you turned it down?
Yeah. They wanted me to read for Judd's part, and I'm like, I'm too young to be this guy. It's like it doesn't seem like a role for me. You know, like I wanted to be the cranky Jewish bigot. You know,
I don't have anything to do with the TV.
I know.
So
I'm sure the play was better.
The play is different.
Okay. Diplomatic, very diplomatic. Okay, go ahead. So Superior Donuts.
And then I acted in a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at Steppenwolf that went to Broadway. It probably doesn't go to Broadway without August Osage County, but because of August, I don't know. There was some interest.
God, you must have killed in that part.
So I did that. It's a great part. It's a great part. And it was a terrific
George,
production
right?
play. Yeah.
And you won the Tony, right?
I did.
That's great.
And then from that's why I started doing all this film and TV. Alex Gonza, who created Homeland, saw me on Broadway. He asked me to do Homeland.
Yeah. That was good, though. You probably that had a little meat to it, didn't it?
Did a couple of seasons of Homeland, yeah. And that's kind of led to all this other shit I've been doing.
Yeah, but you like it.
I'm having a time of my life. It's fantastic. You're talking about a guy who couldn't get on VIP. That's fantastic.
It all comes around.
It's fantastic. But I quit acting on stage. That's why I've had time to write plays and be in movies and TV shows. Because I've acted on stage 8 shows a week, 3 shows a year for 30 fucking years, you know? So
yeah. So you don't do it anymore? It's conscious decision?
I haven't done it in about 4 years.
Because of the time commitment or just because it's too exhausting or what?
It's too hard. It's hard and exhausting and just beats you up.
It's so interesting to me that, like, because you have, like, you're in a lot of stuff right now. I just watched a season opener of Divorce. You were very funny in that show.
Thank you.
This season, that was funny. It's a funny character. I remember you in the Elvis movie. That was sort of an interesting movie, and you were kind of funny. Yeah. And then...
Don't knock yourself out.
No. No, because it's one of those movies where it's like, is this a comedy? What are we doing here?
Mike called me and asked me to come down and do that thing.
No, I like the movie.
Yeah.
But like, I wouldn't call it a comedic part for, you know, there's beats to it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I thought you were great in it, but the movie's one of those in-between movies, right? Kind of? I mean, it is a comedy in a way.
Yeah.
But then The Post is not, that's not a comedic part. That was a great part, serious. Like, I'm just, what I'm doing for my audience, Tracy,
yes.
is establishing you as a character actor with a lot of range.
I see. You've done it. You're doing an excellent job.
I'm not belittling you.
It's clear this is not your first time in the garage.
No. But, and The Lovers, I like that movie too.
Thanks.
He's an interesting director, and that was an interesting movie.
I loved it.
You had a good time, right?
I had a great time.
And
I've been having a great time doing all of this.
Oh, and Christine, too. I saw that movie. I don't think really anyone good. Saw that movie.
Nobody you know saw what? It. Great movie.
Because it's devastating.
It is devastating. It's really good.
It was like I watched it on a plane, and I wanted out.
Yeah.
I wanted off the plane.
Yeah, it's a tough film, but really good.
And that was a serious role. That wasn't a fuck around role.
Yeah.
She's a good actress.
She's a great actress.
Interesting movie, but there was no way that you put yourself through that movie. It's rough.
We used to put ourselves through that movie all the time. Yeah, it was fun. We liked it. You remember
the
70s? Sure. You were alive?
Kind of. I was young. But yeah, that's true. That's true.
Did your folks take you to those tough movies
course,
when you were
of
a kid?
Of course. My grandparents took me to Deliverance way too young.
Ah.
I don't know why.
Nice. See, my folks took me to Serpico. I think I was 6.
Oh, man.
The only movie they ever took me out of was Taxi Driver. And it's because I was 10, and we were in a drive-in.
Yeah.
And the folks started to get uncomfortable.
Oh, my God. You know,
when Jodie Foster showed up, it's like, we need to go.
Yeah, I remember there's a couple movies there. Like, I just remembered another one that nobody saw that I saw too much of was a movie called Prime Cut. It was like a Gene Hackman movie.
Lee Marvin, Sissy Spacek.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And I just remember when I was a kid, when they brought the package of sausages over and said that was so-and-so. Yeah. And I like that right? stuck with
and
me.
And the naked women in the pens.
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah,
they were like on a stockade.
Yeah, it was a crazy movie. I don't even
tough,
know what
tough film.
I don't even remember what it was about.
Well, it's about Lee Marvin. He's a gangster.
But he's competing slaughterhouses or something weird. Like the meat business. I don't.
It was about America, baby.
Yeah,
that's
man.
What it was that's about. Right.
It all comes back to that. This is where Killer Joe comes from. Prime Cut. I didn't think anyone remembered that movie.
Oh, sure.
When was the last time you saw that movie?
Not that long ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I think I showed it to my wife. I think she hadn't seen it. I was like, oh, you got to see this.
Oh, my God.
I own it. I own a copy of
you
Prime
do?
Cut. Oh, yeah.
I got to watch it again. You own a copy on what, Blu-ray? They didn't put that on Blu-ray.
Yeah, or
something.
Something.
VHS?
Something.
It's on a disc, maybe? You digitized it? That's how much you like that movie? I had a Betamax tape, and I didn't want to lose it. So, but But I get, and also in obviously Lady Bird, which is, I think, probably why you're here on some level. This is part of that junket.
I thought you said you've been trying to get me on here years.
I have.
And now you say that I'm on here.
Why are you here? Why are you in Los Angeles? Wait, why? You know,
I'm here for the SAG Awards tomorrow night.
For what?
Best Ensemble for Lady Bird.
Oh, okay. So, are you yelling at me again? I've been trying. What, do you want me to come to Chicago and sit at a sausage place and talk to you?
Great city.
I'd love it. I've been going there a lot. I didn't know Chicago until the last few years, and now I've gone there a lot. I've taped a...
Because you made Easy there.
Yeah, a little before that, too. I taped a comedy special there at the Virgil. Is that it? The Vic? The Vic, yeah, the Vic.
Yeah.
I've been going, but yeah, I taped Easy. Yeah. Easy, yeah. And now, you know, I got to know it a little
bit. You were great in that thing, too.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I like doing that, the improv thing.
That first season, I haven't seen the second season. That first season of Easy did such a nice job of capturing our city, I feel.
He loves it, Swanberg. Do you know him?
I don't know him. I know who he is.
You should reach out to him.
I don't know him personally.
He's a good guy. You should do one of his movies. He just gets a guy and he'll follow you around with a camera. And you won't even know you're making a movie. And then he'll call you a couple of hours.
I don't know that I want that to happen.
It's time. So when... But the range that you exhibit is sort of fascinating to me, because in Lady Bird, you're sort of the good guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you and Lori, like, because I asked her about it, and it was the first time you worked together, and you've known each other forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, it must have been amazing.
That was great fun.
To work with her.
I've been really lucky in that some really good stuff has come my way. Greta sent me the script out of the blue and asked me to do this thing. She had, we did a movie together called Wiener Dog, a Todd Solondz movie.
Right. It was the one I didn't see.
And we're in different vignettes, so we didn't work together on the film. I met her at the premiere at Sundance.
Yeah.
And at the party, which was a terrible party, my wife and I chatted with Greta for 15 or 20 minutes, and that's when she realized I was an old softie. That's why she sent me the script. She's like, you're an old... I thought you were a hard ass from TV. You're an old softy. So she called and asked me to do that thing. It was just... And that's... man, I would sign up for that gig every day. Are you kidding? To have Greta and Lori and Saoirse running the show, and I'm just sitting in the next room reading the newspaper. I'm happy. That's the way it should be.
I love the movie, and I liked all you people that were in it.
Thanks. Though we're going to lose that award tomorrow night.
Why?
I think Three Billboards is going to win it.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's interesting. What does an ensemble mean? How often do you all have to be engaging together?
I don't know.
Yeah. Like Three Billboards is an interesting movie. It's a bit of an abstraction.
Yeah.
Where your movie is not.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I wonder. Are you worried about it?
Not really.
No. What was I going to say? Now, as an actor, what do you find? Give me some pointers. Why do you look shocked? I mean, like, what is your craft based on? Do you just show up and you make choices based on the script?
Yeah.
And that's it.
I put on the clothes and I pretend to be the guy. And I don't know how to do it any other way.
And then occasionally you go like, am I doing the guy right?
Yeah. Is this the guy?
Yeah.
Or occasionally they come up and they go, that's not quite the guy. And I say, you tell me what it is.
Yeah, because you just
tell me and I...
Be a little more aggravated.
I was doing an episode of Homeland and Carrie, my wife, was visiting the set.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm glad you're here because I want to experiment, because I hadn't worked on camera that much.
Yeah.
And a little PC things over the years. And I said, I want to try an experiment. I said, do me a favor and watch me on the monitor.
Yeah.
And so I did a take where I, you know, acted.
Yeah.
And then the next take, I intentionally didn't do any, I was just like sucked all the feeling out of my body, just like this person without salt in their body and did the scene. And when it was over, I said, which was better? And she said, oh, the second one was better. Like, well, there's the lesson. Don't do anything.
So what is it like being married to another actor?
Fantastic.
How long has that been?
Four plus years.
Oh. Wow. And you appreciate each other's work.
Yeah.
And like, have you worked together a lot?
We did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf together.
She played your wife?
No.
She played the younger...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I did an adaptation of Three Sisters, Chekhov's Three Sisters. She did that. And she was in my play Mary Page Marlowe last year. And then we just did The Post. So we've worked together a few times.
How was it being on the Spielberg set?
Scary. Yeah. I was scared.
Yeah. Yeah.
Intimidating. Yeah.
Things move fast, right?
There's Meryl and there's Tom and there's, you know, Steven behind the camera.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I make a Jaws joke and I was like, shit, Jesus, I was 10 when Jaws came out. You know, that's
life changer.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, shit, I grew up watching these movies.
That's right. We're about the same age. I think that Jaws, you know, had a fairly traumatic effect on me. Fucked me up forever.
Right.
I can't swim at night.
You know, sharks don't actually want to eat you. It's taken me a long time to realize that.
Especially not in pools. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even go in a fucking pool. It's just not going to go in the water, dude. It's nighttime.
You're right, especially in pools.
Well, shit, man. This is great talking to you.
Same here.
Are you going to parties tonight?
Fuck no.
Do you think the food's going to be better than the Critics' Choice? Because I saw you at Critics' Choice, and I was going to say something, but I realized I didn't know.
The food is not going to be any worse than at the Critics' Choice.
Whew.
Inedible.
But it was funny, because I did see you, and I'm like, that's Tracy Letts. I should go over there and do what? Like, what am I going to do?
Well, you couldn't get out of your seat once the thing started, because you don't know when your category is coming up. You can't get over to somebody else. Yeah.
My category wasn't even on the televised part. It was before.
I had the Ladybird table to the side of me, and I had the Post table over there somewhere.
Right.
So I sat at the Fargo table because my wife was up for Fargo. So that seemed to be the right.
Right. Nice. Right. Yeah.
Diplomatic way to go with it.
Yeah.
But we were doing double digit losing, double fisted losing.
Everybody's losing.
Yeah. Everybody.
Yeah.
If you weren't with Big Little Lies.
Yeah.
Or Shape of Water, you were losing.
Night. Or the Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Yeah.
Going down. But all right. Well, good luck tomorrow night.
Thanks.
Maybe I'll see you over there, and we'll
probably be at tables where we can't see.
We'll say hello. Because here's the weird thing with me is, like, I think a lot of people, they don't register. Like, if you don't really know this show or whatever, what we're doing here, I'm just a guy, you know, like, I went to some guy's garage, you know, apparently it's a popular thing. And, like, I think, like, they have people don't know. But, like, because I saw the only person, like, Greta's been on my show. I've talked to all these people.
Right.
You know, of all different levels.
That's the high point, right?
Yeah, Obama, yeah.
That's got to be the high point, right?
Definitely. Well, it was an exciting day. Okay. But was it the best conversation I've ever had? No. But it was an exciting day. And it was pretty amazing.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing.
No Did you doubt. Reach out to him? Did he reach out to you?
You want me to text him? I'm kidding. No, it was like his staff reached out about a year before, and it just sort of evolved. The conversation evolved, and then it happened, you know, and it was like, it was a big deal. Big deal. Good president. It's never going to be like that again.
No, I'm afraid not. The pendulum swings.
Yeah, I think it's going to break after this. I think it's going to swing, and it's going to break. But what I was saying was, like, you know, so I see people at the thing, and I don't know how to, you know, because I saw Willem Dafoe just having me walking by me. And, yeah, I had just talked to him in
You'd
here.
You'd been in here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I looked at him, and he looked at me, like, with that moment of sort of like, who is it? And then it was like, that guy. And now I'm projecting, but, you know, it was awkward. So then I realized, like, I'm not saying hi to fucking anybody who's been in my garage. Because I'm just.
Oh, that's sad. I would hope you would say hi to me if I saw you.
This was
thing.
A different experience. Do you know? Because I think
I hope we see each other tomorrow night, so I could just give you like the worst snub you've ever gotten.
Well, in my mind, maybe I'm projecting. In my mind, I think that people just see me as the guy that does the interviews in the garage. You know, and they're
well, they're not paying attention. I don't pay very careful attention to the world, but I know who you are beyond the guy in the garage.
All right, well, that's
I've seen you on your TV show. I know you're a stand-up.
Yeah.
I know you did this.
Yeah. All right.
The whole and Louis C.K. I know who the fuck you are.
Okay, all right. Well, I wasn't indicting you, and now I feel better, because really what I was just trying to do is make it okay for me to say hi to you tomorrow night.
Absolutely, you should say hi. Please say hi.
Thanks for talking.
My pleasure.
Okay, so to That was Tracy Letts. And to complete the story, you know, when I went to the SAG Awards, I went thinking that I could maybe talk to Tracy Letts, maybe have these interactions that I didn't think I could have because he made me feel like I should have them. And I didn't know if it was going to happen. And I wasn't going to go run find him. But I went before the event started. I went to the restroom just to check my hair, actually, and wash my hands. I didn't have to pee. And I walked into the restroom, and who's washing his hands? Tracy Letts. And I see him, and then he sees me in the mirror standing by where I walked in. And it's pretty full of people. And I go, so this is where it happens. This is where it happens. Tracy Letts, this is it. And he turns around, he's laughing. And I'm like, see, we're doing it. We're talking. We're having this event. And he hugged me. I can't quite remember if it was in the bathroom or not. I'd like to think it was. But I think it might have been when we walked out. So I got closure on that. And I feel a little more confident and comfortable in approaching people that I've talked to on this show at award shows as a relative equal. Thank you for that, Tracy Letts, and thank you for coming on the show. You're not listening. And that whole table people, they sat pretty close to me, the Lady Bird people, and I had a deal with Lori Metcalf because Lori, who I love, left her favorite hoodie here, her Steppenwolf hoodie, and she needed it for a photo shoot, and that's where that started to happen. I had to keep going back because I didn't get the name in the phone. So not only did I talk to people, but I annoyed them. I mean, like, I went and got Lori Metcalf's phone number, and they were sitting at the award show, and this was on a break, and I just wanted to make sure I could get her the hoodie in New York. I wanted to have her number. Huh, it was relatively complicated. But I had to go back 2 or 3 times because I kept fucking my phone up. But she got the hoodie, and she sent me a nice card and compensated me for the money I put out to FedEx it. It was a nice, funny card, thanking me with 220s in it, just like my grandma used to send me. All right, that's it. That's our show. No guitar. Boomer lives!